Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Kid Rock's from Michigan. Our next guest is from Michigan. Coincidentally, he was the first guest ever on All Marine Radio. So as we begin our fifth year, it's I don't know if it's appropriate that he comes back because he's welcome anytime. But joining us is former Commandant of the Marine Corps, General Robert B. Neller, retired now. So, sir, welcome back to All Marine Radio. Just started our fifth year.
Mac, good to hear your voice. How is the finest company commander I ever served?
You know what? I'm glad you reaffirmed that because I have people that question that. So, no, I'm good. I'm good. How are you? First of all, give us an update. Where are you these days? What are you doing now that you're retired? I have to tell you, though, on a personal note, your picture that I saw, you look like you found the fountain of youth. Did you find that?
Yeah.
You look younger.
Sleep is a good thing. Sleep is a good thing. Now, we moved to Texas, and our daughter's here with two of our four grandsons, grandson number five on the way. So it was it's like one of those things you never do. You know, how was your transition? And I think I did a horrible job getting ready because I was still trying to serve and do my duty as the commandant. And if you've never done something before, it's a lot of discovery and learning. So no, it's fine. It's every day. You know, life is what happens when you're planning other stuff. And so we're down here, and it's good. It's getting hot though. Going to be 100 tomorrow. So we're not even to the first day of summer, and summer's already here. But all good. Thanks for the opportunity to talk with you today.
No, I saw your letter, but before we get to your letter, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you. I mean, there's been an unprecedented number of retired military chairmen of Joint Chiefs of Staffs, four-star generals, former Secretary of Defenses with Colin Powell that have spoken out here recently about not only the events of last week, but the president. And before we talk about your letter, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you any thoughts on really an unprecedented week in American civil military history.
I've read most of the letters, not at all their entirety. I think General Dempsey was a tweet, and Admiral Mullins was short, and you know, I think Secretary General Mattis got the most attention. John Kelly, John Allen, they're exercising their right as citizens of the United States to express their view. I think everybody's, when you see the video of George Floyd in the last 8 minutes and 46 seconds of his life, it's just, you really can't, it's hard to get your head around that. And so I think that's why the protests are gone on as long as they have. And I think that the great, great majority of them are peaceful and proper, and people out there are calling for a change. And I'm not going to get into the individual comments about personalities and the politics of it, but I tried to stay away from that. I tried to talk about, what's really going to happen, because whether, you use this force or that force to maintain order in the streets, if you need to do that. I think that the real issue is racial justice, and for all Americans, but particularly white Americans, to take a look at, how they see this issue. And, this morning I was watching General C.Q. Brown, who's been confirmed to replace General Goldfein as the Chief of Staff of the Air Force. He's a black man, and if you haven't seen it, I would commend it to you, because it's his, comment on the, how do I feel? What do I think? And it's worth listening to, worth your time. I know General Brown, he's a superb officer, and I think the Air Force and the nation are lucky to have him taken over for another great officer, JML Dave Goldfein at the Air Force. So it's a tough time, but I think it's an opportunity, and hopefully we'll take advantage of it, and all people will, you know, as Abraham Lincoln said, seek to find their better angels in their life.
Let's talk about, actually, I played that video. And again, if anybody didn't hear it, I played it in hour one, and the link to it will be in the post for hour one. I had a chance to meet his wife, and hopefully we'll get out to Hawaii and do some work for them, but doing post-traumatic winning. His comments are outstanding in terms of, you know, what he's gone through in his life. And as you said, how we as, you know, both of you and I happen to be white Americans, and how we as people have to first look inward before we look anywhere else. Let's talk about your letter. Why'd you write it?
Well, I think there were a lot of things. There were, you know, Colonel Tom Hobbs had written a letter about racial issues with officers in the Marine Corps, and I called him and talked to him about it, and it's something that personally been involved with, you know, since I came in. And I came in the Marine Corps post-Vietnam, and quite frankly, the racial, you know, it was after the death of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy and all that stuff that was going on, Vietnam and all volunteer force. So racial relations in the Marine Corps and all the services and the country were terrible. And a lot of militant views and violence from all parties against all parties. And so I kind of grew up in the Marine Corps. You know, people forget that General Wilson, when our commandant, when you were a lieutenant at the basic school, you became a certified human relations instructor, and every Marine had to get 20 hours per year of HumRail, is what it was called. And so you found yourself in a on-air condition, you know, conference room on Okinawa with 150 Marines of all model type series of human beings, trying to explain to them why they should respect each other and judge each other based on the character of their heart and the quality of their effort and their work, and not the color of their skin or where they were from. And did it work? I think it helped, because you had a discussion. You know, and I think people, we wanted to believe the Marine Corps was a merit-based organization, and I do believe it is. But at the same time, we come from the country, and people bring with them, as I said in the letter, they bring with them that whatever culture or baggage or values they had when they were growing up. And so we have laws and policies and rules where you have to, how you're supposed to behave and conduct yourself. But, you know, there's always outliers, just like there's outliers in the police. I don't believe all the police are evil or bad people. I think there's a few out there that, you know, don't understand the concept of protect and serve. So all these things kind of coming together, and I just felt like I had to say something more to collect my own thoughts. And then I decided I would post it. I talked to a couple different media organizations, and they weren't interested. And so I just put it on LinkedIn to see what would happen.
Tell me about the response. Are you surprised by the response? Are you?
I'm encouraged by the response, but again, you know, there's a few people. I don't read everybody's comment. I think most people that are, you know, I think they appreciated the fact that most of the comments say, thanks for not being political. Thanks for providing some actual constructive comments or ideas on how we can get better. Thanks for speaking up. So my intent was to raise the issue and foster the discussion, because really that's the only way it's going to happen, where people talk to each other that you don't normally talk to. That's why I think General Brown's having a conversation. You can't pick up the phone and talk to CQ Brown, but you can listen to him talk to you about how he feels. And it's enlightening. And so everybody's got to, you know, we're better than this. And I think the great majority of Americans treat each other with dignity and respect. But there are a lot of divisions, you know, income divisions, where we live divisions, religious divisions. It's part of our history, and we have to understand that. And so for us to get beyond it, there's going to have to be change. And it's not going to just start and end with the police, which is another discussion you and I had the other day about, you know, policing and, you know, the discussions of defund the police or get rid of the police. Police have to change. I think they know that, and some places have. But change is hard, and it's going to create disruptions. But, you know, no friction, no traction.
You led the Marine Corps during the Marines United event and the aftermath. And community leaders are going to have to deal with a lot of what you dealt with and in a number of different arenas if this thing is going to get traction and not simply be, you know, the outrage phase, then we're going to go to the politicians bloviating phase, then we're going to do some very soft reform, and then you're going to have the interested parties maneuver inside the reform to channel that, and ultimately you're not going to have much of a reform, which is normally the path this stuff goes down. Talk to me about the challenge of getting to the truth and then enacting and then dealing with the real issues relative to a white hot issue like Marines United was, like this will be in the future. Because, you know, when you and I were talking over the weekend, the, you know, that you're going to have in the room, you're going to have the police, you're going to have politicians, you're going to have community activists, you're going to have who else? Those are going to be the major groups. The police are going to walk in and say, look at all these statistics. Every one of them's gone down. We have made great progress since Ferguson with the introduction of body cam footage, all the rest of this stuff, right? But that story's not being told. We're seeing that what we're being accused of is genocide. And there was 10 of these incidents. The cops will tell you that 8 of them were justified, you know, vehicles being used, you know, and resisting arrest that escalated into the hand-to-hand conflict, both in, you know, I just looked at 2018, 2019, and that is the case. And are the activists or Black Lives Matter group going to get up and walk out? You know, at that point, is this thing on TV? Should it not be on TV in the initial meeting so that we can get the common ground? I'm curious, what is your experience relative to the Marines United white hot issue in the country? And what advice do you have for leaders as you go forward?
Well, when the Marines United story broke, I mean, I knew about it. And we'd already been working. I mean, General Amos, when he was a commandant, he had set up a diversity task force, and we had looked at all the issues, women's issues, men of color, ethnicity issues. And it was clear that there's a different view. You say to one group, you know, we want to give opportunity to others, and they say quotas, it's not merit-based. And other groups says there's conscious and unconscious bias. So the first thing is you have to recognize there's a problem. I'd be the first one to admit that. I mean, the Marines United was a webpage where there were, I believe, 30,000 Marines and other service members that joined in a way to connect and help each other deal with whatever issues they were having coming back from the war to help get jobs. And it was a small group. So, I mean, you hear 30,000 Marines and Marines United. It was about 300 guys. Some of them had never even deployed. I mean, they were total posers. And for whatever reason, they had a password-protected page where they would post pictures of female Marines, some not Marines, and, you know, make comments, kind of the way Zuckerberg got started with Facebook. And so we realized we didn't have policies to talk about this. We didn't realize what our prerogatives were with the social media people. We realized we hadn't really gone out and told the Marines, hey, this is the conduct and behavior is expected of you. So we had to write a policy. I mean, everybody signed a statement, which everybody, you know, nobody likes to be told that they're doing something that they're not doing. But hey, look, you got to have rules and policies, even though, you know, the great majority of people are going to comply and don't hold those views. there are those that do, and so you have to make them understand that they can't do that or there's going to be consequences. And so then I went around and I talked with every major base. It took me about a month and a half, held town halls. I think my number, one day at Pendleton, I did 8. And it was not a Q&A. I mean, I went out and told them, here's what happened. Here's the deal. Here's what you're going to do. And the reality in the Marine Corps is, you know, 91% of the Marine Corps is men. And women are at a huge disadvantage just numerically. And then that was also the time when the decision had been made to not restrict assignment to any unit or MOS based on gender. And so there was all sorts of tension with that. And so we had to have a discussion. We had to talk about it. And I had a number of Marines just like to have a discussion about alcohol. We have a problem with drinking. We drink too much. I can say that about the society. It keeps us from being as good as we can be. You know, that's why we all enjoyed being deployed. As one guy told me, Rick Huck told me one day, he says, amazing how much you can get done when you work 7 days a week, 18 hours a day, and everybody's sober. And so we had a discussion, and I think what I learned was this problem is deep. The view that men hold toward women, that ethnicities hold toward each other is deep, and you can't just wave your hand over it, and it's going to take work. And your assessment of how it's probably going to go forward, I don't think this can be handled at the national level. I mean, the national level is going to help because you need leadership and people to talk about it, but it really is going to be cities and counties and states and the people talking to their police and their elected officials about how they want to go forward and how they want to organize, train, and equip their police force or their security forces, how they want to, what they want to teach in school, how they want to evaluate people, how they want to look at their politicians, how they want to decide who holds elected office. So the lesson to me was, this isn't going to, just because you're the commandant, you can't snap your fingers and say, make it so. It doesn't work that way. You have to go out there and lead and explain to people why they should believe or hold these certain beliefs. And we worked on it and we're still not there. I think we're in a better place. You know, one consequence of it is, and we had, there were times where people would post neo-Nazi or extreme rightist things, and other people would call them out, and we would investigate, and those people would be held accountable, and most of them were separated from the Marine Corps with a less than honorable discharge. There's all sorts of, for people on social media, you understand, there's all sorts of people out there unofficially who monitor what's on social media, and they'll call you out, or they'll report you, and there's, as I've told Marines, there isn't a company out there that might look at you as a potential employee that is probably not going to ask for access to your social media, whatever it is, whether it's, you know, TikTok, Instagram, Snapchat. I mean, Facebook's for old people like you and me, Mac, but whatever, they're going to want to see what you post and what you say. And despite what some of these mediums will tell you, oh, it goes away in 24 hours. This stuff never goes away. You know, your tweet, whatever you say, you touch that keyboard, and it's just like you put your fingerprints on it. You cannot hide behind an avatar. And so we all need to grow up. We all need to become better men and women. And because at what point, I mean, how does this make us better? How does it make you better? And so that's rather idealistic, and maybe some would say naive, but you know, I am an idealist. I mean, if you're a Marine, you're an idealist. You believe that, hey, I'm going to go forth and I'm going to serve my nation and I'm going to work really hard. And if I work hard, people are going to recognize me for my performance. And I believe that to be true. And people are going to recognize me for my lack of performance. And I believe that to be true. But it ought to be based on my performance and how I do my mission, not on anything else.
So what advice based on that? And again, I can vividly see you sitting at the table in, I believe it was the Senate Armed Service Committee hearing room, whatever the hell that is, in your alphas, taking face shot after face shot after face shot from politicians, you know, from senators on the committee that just lambasted you. How do you move through the white hot part of this to get to the truth, to get to something that's actionable so that you can make a real difference? Do you have any advice? I mean, you know, as a consultant for communities that will go through this, how do you do it on something that is this white hot, this visible, and is going to continue to evolve? Because again, if those two junior police officers that were on the force less than a week, if they don't get convicted of second degree manslaughter, are we going to go through this again?
Yeah.
You know, it's, and the next time somebody gets shot that's black and somebody records it, are we going to go through this again? So what advice do you have based on the Marines United stuff about getting to the truth and making real change for leaders that are going to go down this road that have never been down this road with such a white hot issue?
Well, you're going to get your, you know, that particular hearing. I mean, it was not enjoyable, but you know, I went up there and as bad as it was, what I think happened, a couple good things happened. Some people who had misguided notion of who I was and what I was about changed their views, particularly on the political side. But more importantly, I think the Marines saw me up there getting beaten like a meat puppet the first day of martial arts training. And I think they got upset. I think they got angry. But I also think they realized that, hey, Neller's the commandant and I'm up there on their behalf. So as I've told everybody, anything good that happens in the Marine Corps, their credit goes to you. If it's bad, then it's on me. So I would tell leaders, hey, look, you have to accept the fact, or at least have a recognition that there's something going on here and there's a problem that you may have, and your problem, you need to figure out, you know, what is the nature of the problem? How deep is it? How dark is it? You know, where does it start? Is it individuals in my organization that are perpetrating this? Do I need to get rid of people? Do I have the policies in place? Because some people, I can't legislate attitudes, but I can legislate behavior.
Right. If you were a community organizer, would you put these things on TV, or would you say some of it, you know, can be on TV? Others, it's important that we sit down here and discuss it privately. So we can.
I don't think any of the discussions needs to be. I mean, there's no. It's like when you bring people in for a presser and you got a bunch of people around the table and the press is asking questions. That's an information operation. That's not a discussion.
Right.
So you have to close the door and there has to be a certain amount of confidentiality if that's possible. But at the same time, you have to make a statement, and it's up to whoever, whether it's the county commissioner or the judge or the school principal or the mayor or the chief of police or the governor, you know, they have to get out there and say, okay, we had a meeting, here's what we talked about, and here's what we're going to do. So that, you know, a lot of the stuff so far, understand the outrage and the anger and the frustration. So what are we going to do? So now we're into the, we got to do something to change this and make it better. And so, you know, whether it's, and everybody's focused on the police right now. And those young, those brand new police officers that were there, you know, you and I've seen it. You know, you got junior Marines out there, and you got more senior guys, and we've seen people commit a violation of law of war, where the senior Marine present, he wasn't stopped by a junior, or the junior, he just said, no, I'm not going to participate.
I'll give you one from both of us when we were in Iraq together, and that was a corporal was asked, you knew it was wrong, why didn't you stop it?
Yeah.
And he said, you know, they said I was a pussy. And I fought with these guys in Fallujah, and they're my guys. And so I went along. And
it's a very, very, very difficult situation, you know. Colonel Andy Milburn wrote an editorial about the use of force, and, you know, he got get in the law and order discussion versus the right of proper assemblage and civil disturbance. And, when we were in Iraq that year, I reviewed 256 violations of the escalation of force and ROE. And for the most part, the Marines used the proper TTPs that we had given them, and they just ended up with a horrible outcome. In a couple cases, there was no way to reconcile what they did, and those Marines were held accountable. But even, some of them, I don't want to waste our time, I could tell you about some of them, but, horrible outcomes, or I could understand why they did. I could rationalize mentally why they did what they did, but I said, I can't condone it. It's easy to sit in a nice air-conditioned room and watch it on TV, and I know when you're out there and it's hot, you're tired, you're wearing all this gear, you've been dealing with, people that are going to harm you or hurt you. And I'm not, the police have a difficult job. I mean, it's just like being a leader. It's really easy to be a leader when everybody that in your organization wants to follow. It's easy to be a cop if everybody's obeying the law and does everything you say. And I think there's a point, like we talked about, and I think part of police reform has to be to take a look at how long an individual is on the street. And because at some point, you either get jaded or your attitude just become insensitive to what's going on. And that's the time. You can't keep those people out there that long.
I can't remember, it was probably 3 years ago, I think the second time you came on, I asked you at the end of the interview, I asked you a throwaway question. Hey, sir, if you could give everybody, now that you're the commandant, one piece of advice, what would it be? And your answer surprised me. And you said, stop drinking. And you said it immediately. And I said, really? And you said, Mac, if you could see what I see from the perspective that I see it at, it would be a no-brainer. And as in our discussion, we were talking about, figure out, how long can you do that before you can't do it anymore? And, I can tell you that going back and forth to Iraq and Afghanistan, you can only do that for so long before you become so jaded that you're more of a liability than you are a contributor. And we talked about that. And so whatever that is, and then so the people that get promoted to sergeants and supervisors and stuff like that, because the cops don't have enough B billet to rotate people out and back. So, create a GI Bill for police officers that then go to school, here's your stipend, here's your GI Bill, go get a degree, go do something else. But the psychological damage, and all you have to do is you have to look at police officer suicide, life expectancy is 10 years less than the general population, their divorce rate is between 70 and 80% in major cities, and their rate of alcoholism, and that alcoholism combined with that hate, it, to me, is a factor in some of this stuff. And then how do you get your hands around it if you're doing it? So to me, this is almost a self-licking ice cream cone. And I related to you the quote Martin Van Creveld gave me after for those people that are old enough to remember, the Israeli Defense Force stood by while Lebanese Christian militia went into the Sabra and the Shatila refugee camps, if I'm not mistaken, yes. in the early 80s and or late 70s, early 80s, and they killed a lot of innocent people. And so I was his military escort as I was leaving IOC, getting ready to go to 3rd LAI, and we were driving down to Camp Lejeune, and I asked him, how could that happen? And he looked at me and he said, we fought too much. And he said, our army, there's a saying, you can only stick a sword in salt water for so long before it rots. And he said, and we have a fair amount of rot, and that's how that happens. And so so that's kind of the background of how do you take care of police officers, in this case, 19 years of being a police officer in a major urban area, and that guy's not jaded, that guy's not, that guy's not pissed off beyond control. And I just don't see that as possible, given what I've seen from Marines, as we have come and gone to war. And I want to ask you, I mean, I don't know how much you've read about, you know, about the issue of police unions, a thing like that. From your reading, do they have too much power in terms of the adjudication process? Is that?
You know, I don't know enough about it. I've just been reading about that because it's recently come up about police unions and their ability to impact the discipline or the corrective action. Again, but, you know, what we saw with the guy, the officer up in Minneapolis, I mean, the thing that was the most troubling about that, I think, was the fact we could sit here. I don't know what his personal story is, but, you know, he was totally impassive. And that, to me, told me that there's something. Once you lose your ability to have empathy and compassion for another human being, you know, that there's a word for that. It's called being a psychopath. And how that, and he had a number of complaints of her excessive force and how that wasn't adjudicated. At some point, you're like, hey, look, you know what, this isn't the place for you, or you need to go. But what do you do? Where do you send a police officer? They didn't make him a detective. He wasn't a sergeant. But as troubling was the other guy standing there keeping the crowd away. The crowd is sitting there saying, hey, he can't breathe, let him go, let him go, let him go. But none of them intervened. Nobody made a rush. I mean, you know, in an effort to do something. And the two junior guys are, I didn't even see them in the video. But so it's a bigger issue. So how do you manage, you know, who do you pick to be a police officer? How do you train them? I think the training, I don't know enough about it. I'm trying to get involved in that here in the local area. The police chief in Austin, Chief Manley's under a lot of pressure. I think I believe he has a good heart and he grew up here. It's his hometown. I don't think he actually has empathy and understanding and compassion for both the police force and for the people of the city. But just like any other leader, I mean, you have people that do stuff and you're responsible because you're in charge. So he may get, you know, they ask for his resignation. I don't think that's going to solve anything because unlike most police departments, you know, they don't bring in somebody from the outside. He's here, but I don't think that makes him compliant with what's going on. So I don't know. I mean, it's very difficult, but I think there's going to have to be, I think that's what probably one, the first thing and maybe the easiest thing to look at, you know, how police are trained, how they're selected, how you cycle them to give them a break. You know, and there's a book, I would mention it to you, but, you know, I've talked a lot about the mental aspect of your life and your discipline and how you help people. And you and I know many guys and gals that still dealing with stuff from the war. And quite frankly, it'll never go away, but, you know, you manage it. And we tried when we were over there to get people in and out. And sometimes you just need to get a good night's sleep and on a clean bed, need some good chow. But it's, you know, it wears you down. That's why I think when we did the 6-month deployments, it was a smart move for those that were out on the street as opposed to doing a year. And the Army finally adjusted and went to 9 months, which I think was a good decision. But people wear out. I'm not condoning illegal behavior. I'm just saying you have to recognize the fact that at some point, you know, there's a book I would commend to everybody. It's a very short book. It's called The Anatomy of Courage, and it's written by a guy named Moran, who was a physician in World War I and later Winston Churchill's doctor. And he talks a lot about the mental part and he gets in the discussion. Well, you just be disciplined and we treat everybody hard and we're, you know, they'll suck it up. And no, they won't. I think the quote is something like this. Any human being is like a fine suit of clothes. And no matter how well made, eventually they will wear out. And so we have to figure out a way. And what do you do? I mean, do you early retirement? Do you? You know, how long can you stay on the street? Do you move them? How do you move them to other places? Do they all end up being a school resource officer? Do you give them a break, bring them back? You know, you get at a certain point, you just can't keep up the grind. And, or do you find older, more mature people? Because we know men mature later than women. We know that's a fact. That's why the special ops model is, you know, we're not going to take anybody until they become a sergeant or a E6 staff sergeant, because we want them to be older, more mature. And, you know, it's interesting when we talk to the guys down at Marine Special Operations Command and they have their qualification, and we were looking at all the things that they did and the tests that they did. And I said, well, what's the profile for people that make it through the training? And they go, you know, that's interesting. The one trait or characteristic that we find that's common to everybody that's successful is they have empathy. Not that they're hard, they're all physically fit, not that they're this, but they have empathy because they can put themselves in the position of the other person.
Wow. Well, and you know, I mean, how many investigations did you read where the preliminary statements were, you know, he was the senior Lance Corporal, and they replied, hey, we got this, we know the deal here. And it's that I've done it too long and I've lost empathy, and it's just it's almost a door opener. I want to ask you, you had very direct, you addressed white population of the country, black population of the country, law enforcement officer, racist, and leaders specifically in your letter.
Yes.
I want to ask you about that, and then I want to ask you, get your thoughts on the power of video as we kind of finish up here in the next 8 minutes, so you can move on to your next agenda item on your day. But talk to me, tell everybody about what you said to whites, blacks, law enforcement officers, and racists and leaders. What was your message to each one of those groups?
Well, as a white person, I mean, it's difficult. That's why you can try as best you can to put yourself in the place of somebody who's a different gender or ethnicity than yourself. But it's difficult, but you have to try. That's why I said, listen to CQ Brown. I'll give you, so back in 1983, I was at the basic school and we're putting lieutenants through, and a friend of mine, one of the other platoon commanders, was a African-American officer. You remember when the A6 got shot down over Syria and Jesse Jackson went to get the pilot?
I do.
Returned, he made the negotiation. And so I'm sitting there with my buddy and we're watching the news, and he goes, the guy's wife is white. I said, what? He says, the guy's wife is white. I said, what are you talking about? He says, I'm telling you, his wife is white. That's why they're not showing her. They're not showing her because he was African-American. And then, you know, Jackson, they land in the United States, he's repatriated, and then his woman runs out to hug and kiss her husband, and she's white. And I'm like, he says, look, I'm a black man. You don't see the world the way I see the world. You haven't lived in the world that I've lived in. I said, okay, you got my attention, I'm listening. So we started to have a discussion about, you know, black and white. And I think that's what has to happen now. And you, if you don't want to have the discussion, you want to sit there and believe that, you know, everybody's going to be treated the same. And it's not the case. Last night on ESPN, they had a 30 for 30 about Bruce Lee and about all the stuff he went through trying to break into Hollywood as a Chinese Asian actor. You know, he's on the Green Hornet, he's the number two guy on the Green Hornet. And the lead actor is getting $2,200 a month. He's getting $250. So, I mean, it's part of, you know, we all built this country.
As in $250 a month?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, he was getting paid, you know.
An eighth
of what the lead guy was getting. And they didn't give him any speaking parts until he complained about it. So, I mean, to the white Americans, hey, look, this is a problem. And you probably don't, you know, and where do you have that opportunity to engage? To the African-American community, you know, I was just trying to say, hey, look, you know, I hear you, I'm trying to understand, I know you're upset, you're rightfully upset, but, you know, on the violent part, you know, okay, I can understand it, but Don't let people that are at both ends of the spectrum hijack what's really important, which is about your quest for social justice. To the leaders, to the police, you know, where I kind of talked about that. Hey, look, you guys can't, you got it. You can't let others, you know, I think most police are like most Americans. They're good people who believe in right and wrong, and they're not going to stand by and let somebody be unnecessarily injured or hurt. But you can't be silent anymore. You got to call out people in the department, and it might be the chief or a senior. And that's a high risk. It's easy to say sitting here, you know, on the radio, but you know what you're going to cost you your job.
Right.
And then to leaders, you know, they can sit there and point fingers and all that, but until they take a look at those things that, you know, everybody's going to have an idea. I mean, they're going to take money from defense and put it toward the community. They're going to defund the police and do more public policing, you know, this and that. And they're going to, you know, talk about this. They're going to have laws and, you know, make a police code of conduct. And those are probably all good things because they'll cause a discussion and they'll have people will testify and there'll be data. But right now it's more about this November and all that, which is of mild interest, you know, right now. And I kind of wish we would do like other countries in the election, that we had good campaign for 30 days and then we would vote.
That would have
been over the course of a week, not on a Tuesday when we used to go to the market when we drove our horse pulled wagon.
That would be helpful.
It would, you know, so in Texas, though, they actually have early voting. So you can vote for, you know, weeks and weeks and weeks before Election Day, which I think is a really smart thing to do. And
right.
Hopefully most states will have something similar, if not the ability to vote because of the COVID thing, vote using a mail-in ballot like you and I have done many times because we were stationed outside our state of residence.
Talk to me. I want to, real quick, the power of video. The USS Theodore Roosevelt becomes a international issue because, you know, you had in a crew of 4,800, you had about 100 and some odd sailors chanting the name of the captain as he leaves the ship.
Yeah.
That the power of that video vaults that issue into national prominence. Video is a powerful tool. You know, Marines urinating on bodies in Afghanistan, something the Marine Corps dealt with. Leaders that have to deal with these issues that get so inflamed, and video as a part of that. Your thoughts on that?
Well, as for leaders, I would say never assume that you're not being recorded and that words matter. So back in the day when, you know, we could stand in front of battalion formation and, you know, say whatever we said, maybe things that we wouldn't say now today or because it's all being recorded. And I think that's a good thing. It makes everybody pay attention because words matter and we need to be careful with our words. But the you know, what, you know, before, you know, without video, say, well, this is what happened. Well, prove it. Well, I think the George Floyd killing is the video is what I think is greatly responsible for the understandable and proper outcry because you're watching a guy die right before your eyes. And so everybody's a reporter. Everybody's got a camera. But at the same time, taking a video does not remove your responsibility for action if you see something wrong. You know, if I'm out in the street or I'm hurt or something bad is happening to me, I need you to help me. I don't need you to video me. I need your help. You know, so again, I'm asking people, there's risk here. It's the safe thing to do. You know, it's just like we used to complain about the media because they would video it, but they wouldn't, you know, and then they would get in trouble and they might ask for our help. I mean, I'm not chipping on the media. They have a job to do. But, you know, it's difficult. And now, that said, with artificial intelligence and all sorts of digital enhancement, you can create false video. And we've already seen that on social media. And so then the question is, okay, is this real or not? And I'm sure there's people out there that might even say that the video of George Floyd was not real. I mean, some conspiracy theorist. But we have to, you know, so how do you confirm the authenticity of a statement or a video. That's why social media is both a great way to bring people together and spread information and educate people. It's also easy for those that would choose to take the path to create a false narrative or to message people to not believe what's really the truth. So we're in a very interesting space. We're in a very interesting space, and I think we all need to be cognizant of how we use and what we see and where we get our information.
If a community is interested in your services as a consultant on something like this, because you've been down this road before, are you willing to help? Or
sure.
And how do they contact you?
I'm trying to get hold of the Austin Police Department right now to offer my assistance if they want it on training, to look at their training. I think anybody, and I'm no different than most of us that are serving, any experienced senior military leader, I could think of hundreds of men and women out there that have experience and some of the stuff we've talked about today that could provide their perspective. And not that we lived in the world that we lived in, and we weren't civilians, we were in the military, and we, not that we were separated from the rest of the world, could be easily isolated, and we went and did things that other people didn't do. So we have different perspective and experiences, not right, not wrong, just different. And so sometimes I think we can, just like, you have a group of people, if you have everybody that's lived in the same place, done the same thing, grew up in the same area, it's harder for somebody to think of something that they haven't seen or heard before. So you want to get a discussion going, you got to get people that represent various experiences and groups and genders and ages, so that you get, the whole perspective, if you want to talk about the entire depth and breadth and spectrum of the issue. But sure, I would be happy to help anybody that thought I might be of some service. Right. Now you're going to get me crushed on.
I know you mean that. And you wouldn't have wrote, a lot of people wrote a lot of different things last week. What stood out immediately to me and my friends who saw your letter, who pointed it out to me because I didn't initially see it, was you speak about leadership. You speak about doing something about this. You speak specifically to groups and to leaders, and so your letter was different. And knowing you, and where you come from, I know that you mean that sincerely, and that if somebody wants your help, ask for it. But I just wanted people to hear that. This is the general question right at the end. What haven't I been smart enough to ask you that you want people to know about either what you wrote or what you're feeling and this issue?
We all come from where we've been. And again, I tried to frame who I was and how I saw things based on the beginning, because I'm a baby boomer. I'm a 67-year-old white guy that was a Marine for 44 years, and now I live in Texas. And, grew up in high school during the height of the Vietnam War and in the height of the Civil Rights Movement, and remember the riots in Detroit, even in my hometown of Lansing, and my parents being afraid. And my dad, God rest his soul, was a racist bigot. I mean, he was. Not outwardly, but I know that he just, the things that he said and did, at the time, I wasn't smart enough, or maybe I was just too afraid to call him out, but he passed away many years ago. And I think maybe he did change, but probably not. So we all come from where we come from. So I guess I would say, it's my perspective. You have your perspective. I respect that. I don't expect you to agree with everything I said, but I think the time, I guess the most salient point is we can't let this opportunity pass. The death of George Floyd and the death of others you know, you just watch it and you're like, okay, did this really have to happen? And again, I have empathy for the police. They're in tough positions. They have to make sometimes snap decisions. But the question is, did you have to resort to the force that you used to solve the problem? Or could you just walked away? So I know there had been criticism, just like there was criticism. You know, it's funny that at the end of my time in the Marine Corps, and the people say, well, how do you think you did? And I said, well, I don't know. History will judge that. I said, what do you want to be remembered for? I want to be remembered that I gave a shit about Marines and the institution and trying to make ourselves better. And it's funny, Mac, the only, you know, the number one thing that I got pushback on of anything I did, it wasn't about women. It wasn't about changing the organization. It was about alcohol. And, you know, hey, we're Marines. We're supposed to be drunks. No, you're not. I mean, you can drink. You're grown men and women. I trust you, but you can't be a drunk. Nobody likes a drunk. And so this issue, just like alcohol in the country, and it's not just the Marine Corps, but I mean, it's a fact. Marines of all the services, because we're youngest, 65% of Marine Corps is 25 years old or less. We drink too much, which doesn't facilitate our decision-making process. And we are better than that. We can be better. Just like the nation, if they're willing to first look at themselves and say, how do I feel about this issue? And then what am I going to do about it? And how am I going to teach my children and my grandchildren about this so that, you know, we end up in a better place, you know, hopefully down the road.
All right. I've got one quick email for you. Mac, I'm a community leader. I turned in late. I'm a retired Marine. What's the one thing General Neller would tell me to focus on as my community brings all people to the table?
You know, that's a tough question because I don't think getting everybody, all the different advocates and constituencies in the room at one time, you know, it's almost like, you know, we would go through a mission analysis. Okay, here's where we are. Here's the general situation. Okay, what's the mission? What do we want to do? And then, you know, at the end of this, what is this? What do we want our community to look like? So if our mission is, you know, I think the mission every community wants is we want a safe, prosperous, culturally collective, homogeneous society where people treat each other with dignity and respect. Okay, that's my end state. Okay, so what are the things I have to do to get there? What do I have to do? I have to address homelessness. I got to address employment. I got to address you know, teenage pregnancy. I got to address drug and alcohol abuse. I got to address mental health. And so it's the same stuff. So, and everybody's, I mean, so you can start with the police if you want. And just like, you know, when this nation, you know, went through, finally integrated, started to integrate, it was the military that led with some success. So if it changes, you know, we're trying to create a better society, you want to start with the police, that's fine. But you can't, it's not the end. It's not the end.
I took the question to be more in terms of facilitating that, not specific issues to tackle. In terms of facilitating that process, is there something that as you tackle tough issues, is there something that you would emphasize to groups that we're going to tackle these issues? Hey, I'm not going to tell you about the issue. Let me tell you about the way we, is there something like a piece of advice like that you would give?
No, I think the mission, that's what I was trying to convey. And I apologize for not being clear, but I think they need to sit down and go, okay, here's where we are. Here's what's going on. Let's assess our own community. What do we think? Come up with a list of characteristics or things in our community. What do we think we're in a good place about, and what are we not? And then at the end of it, okay, so these are the things we don't think we're doing well in. What are the things we have to do to rectify this or improve it? I mean, you're not going to make it. It's not going to be. We have to be realistic, but at the same time, you don't want to make it. You know, you don't want to ignore it. And some of these are tough problems.
Right.
This stuff just didn't happen today.
And as you said, it's not one problem. It's problems.
It's not. It's
layer
not
on each
problem.
Other. Right. All right. I know you have to go, and you've been more than generous with your time. I hope you'll come back in the future as this issue continues to evolve, especially the community leadership aspect, and come back on and talk about it again. I enjoyed the conversation, sir.
Yeah, Mac. Well, I'm trying to type something up about what we talked about with, you know, police reform, defunding the police, whatever that means. You want to change the police. Absolutely. And some places apparently have done that successfully, but and that may be a place to start, but it's not going to solve all these issues.
No,
it's a step, but it's got to be more than that.
Yeah. You got to evolve. You got to evolve them. And I think the you look at what happens to a police officer. And as you said, we've got to be better than this. We've got to care more about them, and that is going to impact this issue as well. And so let's have a conversation about that. But anyway, yeah. All right, sir. I appreciate
all
the conversation.
You be safe.
I will.
All right, get ready when baseball starts for the Tigers to become the world champions.
Sir,
are you ready?
With bated breath, we're ready on that one.
It's like Joe Dunford, you say, if you don't have a dream, you can't have a dream come true, right?
You're not.
And the Lions are going to the Super Bowl.
All right. Look, I know it's obviously hot. It's affected you. So stay out of the sun the rest of the day.
All right. Stay safe.
All right. Thanks, sir.
I'll talk to you later. Bye.
You bet. That is General of the Marine Corps, former time, now retired, Bob Neller. You know, as somebody who's been elected to public office, and General Neller was in Iraq when I got elected. The hardest thing is to get people to come that want to solve the problem. And people are going to come to the table with all kinds of different agendas. Some are just going to want to make a statement and push their agenda to a wider audience and aren't really interested in the community solution. So to me, finding the right people that are interested in that is the first hard thing. And then, can you get everybody that shows up to be articulate in their advocacy, articulate in their debate, and articulate in dissent? Can you reflect that in what you create, right? Can you create and what you create? And it's not easy on these difficult issues, right? It's not easy on these difficult issues. But we, you know, as a nation, we have to get there. Let me tell you, and I think for those of us who've been around the world, there's no country like the United States. Okay, and I think when guys like General Neller and myself, who grew up in the '60s, you know, he talks about his dad was a bigot, you know. My dad managed baseball teams in Alabama. So I went there as a kid. Like, so I would have been in 1966 and 67. I would have been 9 and 10 years old rolling around Alabama as a kid. Right? I saw signs that said white only. And I remember as a kid, I mean, I didn't understand it. Like, what does white only mean? I'm white, so I can obviously drink out of that fountain. I didn't understand it. And the first issue relative to race that I remember is my sisters and I in Birmingham, Alabama, or Mobile, I'm not sure which one, Mobile. We were in the parking lot. It was a gravel parking lot outside of the baseball field. And they were baseball stadiums built during the Depression, and they're, you know, they're old stadiums, but really cool. But anyway, my dad used to take his time, you know, after ball games. And so we'd be out there. Everybody is gone, right? Most of the players are gone. All the players were gone. And my mom's leaning against the back of our car. and she's smoking a cigarette, as she did. And we're playing with the black kids in the neighborhood. And the trainer for my dad's team came out, and he was dumping the garbage or something in a, you know, in a dumpster. And he saw those black kids and us playing with them, and he started screaming at those black kids. And he scared the shit out of us. You know, you can tell, you know, when you're a little kid, sometimes it's not what the person says, but it's how they say it. I mean, and I knew something was wrong. So we all kind of gravitated towards my mom. So it would have been myself. I would have been 10. My younger sister would have been 8. My older sister would have been 12. And then my youngest sister would have been 4 or 5. And so we went over to our mother, Corporal Punishment Kathleen, who was dressed, you know, in a dress, and we were all, I was in slacks, and my sisters were in dresses, because we weren't, you know, this is where my dad worked, and we're playing, and, you know, and we're playing tag with these kids. And we went over to my mom, and we looked at her, and she said, and he was telling those black kids to, you know, to get the F out of there, and, you know, and he was, you know, using the N-word, a word that we didn't grow up hearing, and the tone of his voice, you know. And so we went to my mom, and we said, did we do something wrong? And she said, no. And then she looked at us, she said, go keep doing what you're doing. Go play tag with those kids. And we said, okay. And so we went back and we continued to play, and he was furious. And he stormed back in the clubhouse after he got done dumping his garbage. But, you know, we all are a product of, you know, of that. And, you know, and so for General Neller and I, you know, we grew up hearing the N-word as a noun. Right? Not as any kind of, you know, racial epithet. It was just a word that, you know, people used. And we grew up in when there was Jim Crow, when there was systemic racism. So we look at our culture today and we don't see it so much. And I think the danger is, you know, are we blind to it? And I think that's his, as a white guy, to me, that's his admonition to all of us, is that, you know, it's still out there, and you need to take a look at it. And you need to look inward before you look outward. And let me read to you his admonition for white America. Even though you believe you are not racially prejudiced, and that you raise your children to judge others by their actions and values, not their ethnicity. And then I would add, you know, as Martin Luther King said, the content of their character, not the color of their skin. You have to try as best you can to understand the views of people of color who are just tired of real injustices they live with every day. Things that you either have not seen or cannot see. They are their reality. And if you would speak to any man or woman of color and ethnicity about their experience, they will tell you their story. Listen and change. So that's General Neller's admonition, you know, to the rest of us, is before we look outward and point fingers, to look inward to see if, you know, are we doing what we should be doing? Are we doing it to the best of our ability? And I believe that's what's called for. And then to be able to have a grown-up conversation about these issues, to be able to have a conversation that's based in the truth, and then where can we go to make sure that whatever reforms that get made are real, are meaningful, and are substantial. And again, that is what we owe this great nation, this great experiment, because there is no other nation that's as far down the road as we are relative to race relation. I mean, for those of us that have been around the world and seen it, doesn't exist. We are the melting pot. So, anyway, I always enjoy having him on. Come on, I've known him. He was an officer at the basic school when I was a student at the basic school. And my thanks to him for coming on today. Tomorrow, Alex Hollings will join us. So we'll talk about a bunch of this stuff. Anyway, more of Auburn Radio coming up next. And what I would tell you is the audio from General Brown that General Nelly talked about, is included in hour one. So, and then we kind of do the news, talk about this problem, right? Where do we go? Right? You have Democrats already, you know, coming out with an announcement about legislation they're crafting, but the states and the cities that have the biggest problems are all run by the Democrats, right? The police unions in those states, you know who they contribute money to? Not Republican candidates, Democrat candidates, because they're the ones that get elected and they want to say. So how do we fix this thing? And I would tell you that, you know, in terms of where this goes, you know, identifying the problem, and that's not going to be, and the problem isn't just the police, right? And the police are going to point that out. The police are going to point out that 54% of the charged homicides in this country go to a group that is 13% of the population, and we deal with them on a repeated basis. So maybe we are spring-loaded, but maybe that's just the reality of where we live and work, and we can't be blamed for the whole thing. Well, that's not an easy thing for, you know, that's not an easy thing to digest. And I hear more and more conservative black commentators making the statement of, we as a culture have to get our shit together. We have to stop this epidemic of teenage pregnancy in our culture, so that our young women go to college, get good jobs, and move those families, you know, to wherever the hell they want to live. So, not easy, questions. And so, to me, what was refreshing about General Neller's letter was that it addressed the leadership aspect and the different groups that will certainly be there at the table as we begin to take a look at this issue. Right, and again, you can feel the issue polarizing people, because already today you've had the Attorney General and the Secretary for Homeland Security saying, "Hey, look, you know, we could show you the numbers, right? Systemic racism? No, the numbers don't bear that out." And you can imagine, you know, how that flies in people who have a different narrative. So, anyway, you'll hear some of that, and then you'll hear General CQ Brown's, it's about 5 minutes, his message about, and again, he's different, you know, you're going to hear him from the manner in which he speaks. I mean, he's really a smart guy. You can imagine he's not your quintessential typical, you know, black man in this country. And he talks, and you'll hear him talk about that. We were the only two, his sister and he were the only two black students in his, I think, grammar school or high school. Right. And they struggled to fit in. Then he went to a school that was 80% black, and they struggled to fit in there. Where do I fit in? And so you have to confront that. So hard issues require adults that will be respectful, articulate, and that will work for the greater good of the community. Right. And that's how we do it. That's how we do it in this country. So, but again, it's hard because the media doesn't seek the truth. Politicians do it for their own agenda. And man, that stuff makes it really, really difficult to get to a good place relative to this. So on a Monday, thanks for listening. Right. And again, I think take the Commandant's tasking personally. Look inward before you look outward. You know, for guys like me, I mean, one of the things I thought of this week was, am I too old to be a big brother to somebody? To a little kid? Uncle Mac? Come on, you want to come hang out and do yard work with me this weekend? You know? You want to relentlessly pursue taking out a stump of a tree? And one of the lessons you're going to learn is relentless pursuit of whatever you want is what wins. Right? Don't worry about being perfect. Right? Be relentless. That's what wins. and we're going to practice on this fucking tree stump, which is something I did yesterday. I took out a tree stump with a circular saw. Now, you're not supposed to be able to do that. And my neighbor, who's a former naval aviator, Vietnam type, he came over late in the afternoon, and he said, "You're out of your mind." I said, "I think I broke my saw." He goes, "Well, no shit, man." He said, "You've taken this whole thing down with this?" I said, "Yep." I said, "I decided in my head that it was going, and so it had to go." And he started laughing. He goes, "That's awesome. But am I too old to do that? Am I too old to make a contribution like that? You know, is there another vehicle?" So we can all do more, and we need to. And we need to. So, again, we're all fortunate to live in the greatest country, right? But it doesn't mean that we can't make it greater. And you know, maybe this is a wake-up call for all of us that we need to push it further down the road. And maybe we can say, well, this doesn't happen as much anymore. Okay, maybe that's true. But maybe if we all reached out to people that were disadvantaged in some way, shape, or form, we could enable them to achieve in a way that's been difficult in the past. Maybe we could do that. And in that way, we make our country greater. So have a great day. On a Monday, Almarin Radio, over and out.